All right, so now we've had a bit of a look at some of the virtue ethics approaches. As I said before, there are basically the big three ways of looking at or approaches or styles of approach for looking at morality. And of course, we have the virtue approach with Plato and Aristotle. Now, their approaches, as we've seen, their virtue theories are very different from one another in some ways and very similar to one another in other ways. But, of course, as with any sort of idea in the history of ideas, there are challenges to this. I mean, of course, we're all seeking understanding of, you know, the truth. We want to understand these things, and so, of course, if that's the case, we want to be sure we get them right. And it's not long after Plato and Aristotle that we get a challenge not just to Plato and Aristotle and their particular approaches to virtue ethics, but we also get the beginnings of an entirely different kind of approach, the beginnings of a different way of looking at things. So that's what I want to look at now. This is coming from a philosopher, again, ancient Greek, by the name of Epicurus. And you may have heard the name Epicurus before, or at least maybe the adjective Epicurean. There's a word Epicurean that sometimes people use these days to describe somebody who's generally the way it's used today is to describe somebody who is a foodie, if you will, somebody who enjoys delicious, tasty, lavish, sometimes foods. And once we get a little bit better understanding of what Epicurus is actually about, you'll see why Epicurus himself would probably not have been very pleased with his name being used in that way. In any case, Epicurus is well known, but we don't have a whole lot of his actual writings. Plato, of course, we have all these dialogues, we have a bunch of his letters. Aristotle, we have all these notes. Of course, we're also missing a lot of Aristotle. There's apparently, the historians tell us that Aristotle wrote a bunch of dialogues too, just like Plato did, but none of those have survived. So we really have more kind of textbooks and notes and things like that. But still, we have a whole lot. We have a whole lot of material from Plato and a whole lot of material from Aristotle. We don't have a whole lot from Epicurus. A lot of what we know about Epicurus comes from what other people have said about him. But we do have enough to get a pretty decent little picture of what he's out about here. And I've given you one of the more well-known things here called the Letter to Menoesius, in which Epicurus lays out some of his basic broad ideas. So there's a couple things in here that I want to point out, and I want to talk about a very famous argument that that Epicurus has put forth, and I want to get your take on it, to see what you think of this approach that Epicurus is talking about, and what you think about specifically some of these arguments that he's put forth. So first off, we see something in the beginning paragraph here that you might recognize as being a little bit counter to something that one of our previous philosophers says. He says, "Let no one be slow to seek wisdom when he is young, nor weary in the search thereof when he is grown old, for no age is too early or too late for the health of the soul." And to say that the season for studying philosophy has not yet come, or that it's past and gone, is like saying that the season for happiness is not yet, or that it's now no more. Therefore, both old and young ought to seek wisdom, the former in order that as age comes over him, he may be young in good things, because of the grace of what has been, and the latter in order that while he is young, he may at the same time be old, because he has no fear of the things which are to come. So we must exercise ourselves in the things which bring happiness, since if that be present, we have everything, and if that be absent, all our actions are directed toward attaining it. So, a few pretty big, obvious points here. First off, we saw with Aristotle that he's not too keen on you youth, right, studying philosophy and politics especially. Now, that's, again, not to say that Aristotle is trying to say you should just be sort of cloistered and you shouldn't be taught anything. He's just saying you ought not to, you're not quite ready to do the big, heavy stuff. Epicurus seems to be saying here, well, no, you know, we kind of need to start them young, right? We kind of need to at least get them on the track of pursuing understanding. Philosophy, in this sense, remember, is not a specific discipline like it is today. It really basically just means all kinds of inquiry, all kinds of seeking of knowledge. And then we have at the end of this paragraph something else worth noting. Everything is happiness, right? Everything is happiness. If happiness is present, we have everything. Everything is done. We don't need anything else. Happiness is it. Happiness is the big goal. And if we don't have happiness, everything we're doing is directed towards getting it. That sounds very much in agreement with Aristotle. So we have this agreement that happiness is the good, but we end up with a different approach. One of the problems that later philosophers had with this virtue approach. Remember, the virtue approach says we need to focus on what kind of person should I be, and then once that's done, we should then realize that actions, right actions, will just sort of naturally happen. But a complaint against that is, okay, well, but if you're telling me what I need to do is to properly harmonize my tripartite soul, or, in the case of Plato, or seek the golden mean between vices, in the case of Aristotle, and so on. If that's what you're telling me I need to do, don't I need to, you know, like, do stuff to get there? Don't I need to act in certain ways? Don't I need to actually make decisions in the here and now about which path to follow, which choice to make, which action to undertake? Don't I need to actually focus on actions before I can? I mean, I need to do things to get to the goal that you're telling me to get to. And you don't really tell me, Plato and Aristotle, you don't really tell me what to do. I have a decision to make today, right? I have a moral dilemma that I'm facing right now. There's choice A, there's choice B. I haven't succeeded in achieving the eudaimonia or the perfect harmony of the tripartite soul or whatever. I haven't done that yet, and yet I still have a decision to make today. And you haven't really told me, either of you, how to do that, right? In other words, a big complaint is that, well, you know, you virtue ethicists kind of bypass or dismiss the here and now action decisions we need to make when really those are actually quite important. So, now, if we're going to focus on action, and we're going to act in order to attain happiness, how do we do that? How do we go about doing that? Now, in the rest of this, in the rest of this letter, Epicurus is kind of, he doesn't come out right out and say it, right? I mean, this is, again, this is really early days. He doesn't come right out and say it like we're going to get further development in some people coming later in more modern times. But we get hints of the second of what we call the big three ways of approaching morality. So, okay. The big goal here is happiness. How do we get it? What should we do in order to achieve, in order to attain happiness? What Epicurus is going to talk about here is a lot of the things that are preventing our happiness, a lot of the things that are standing in our way, and what we need to do in order to avoid those pitfalls, knock down those roadblocks, if you will. Okay, so let's go into this second paragraph here. He says, talks about gods here, and he says, there are gods, and knowledge of them is evident, but these gods are not such as the multitude believe. Seeing that people do not steadfastly maintain the notions they form respecting them, Not the person who denies the gods worshipped by the multitude, but he who affirms of the gods what the multitude believes about them is truly impious. For the utterances of the multitude about the gods are not true preconceptions, but false assumptions. Hence, it is that the greatest of evils happen to the wicked, and the greatest blessings happen to the good from the hands of God, the gods, seeing that they are always favorable to their own good qualities. Now, that's an interesting claim. That's an interesting claim that that Epicurus is making here. What he's saying here is that the multitude, that is the majority of people, right? The multitude, the common people believe in the gods, but the gods aren't as the multitude say. The gods are sort of different, and if you just kind of follow what the multitude believes, and you just believe something about the gods just because, I don't know, maybe you've been told to, or maybe that's what other people believe, and you just kind of follow along with what they believe, that means you are truly the impious one. It's the ones who deny that stuff, worshipped by the multitudes, that are actually in a better stead. Now, that point about the gods is an interesting one, that the gods are not quite as the multitude tend to believe. And that's going to come back to help Epicurus make a point in a little bit. But this next paragraph is where we get Epicurus's most famous, most well-known argument. Accustom yourself to believe that death is nothing to us. For good and evil imply awareness, and death is the privation of all awareness. Therefore, a right understanding that death is nothing to us makes the mortality of life enjoyable, not by adding to life an unlimited time, but by taking away the yearning after immortality. For life has no terror for those who thoroughly apprehend that there are no terrors for them in ceasing to live. Foolish, therefore, is the person who says that he fears death, not because it will pain when it comes, but because it pains in the prospect. Whatever causes no annoyance when it's present causes only a groundless pain in the exception. Death, therefore, the most awful of evils, is nothing to us, seeing that when we are, death is not come, and when death is come, we are not. It's nothing then either to the living or to the dead. For with the living, it's not, and the dead exist no longer. Now, this is really an interesting point that that Epicurus is making, and I want you to kind of pause for a minute and think about what this means. Think about what this argument that Epicurus is giving us actually means. And then, of course, think about whether you agree, whether you think that this is a proper way of looking at it. So, what's going on with this argument? Well, Epicurus is kind of making the point that, look, happiness is our goal. One of the big things, one of the big evils that we hold in our minds that tends to stand in the way of happiness is fear. And when we're talking about fear, the big kahuna, the big thing that most of us fear the most is death. If we could kind of get around that fear, if we could get rid of that fear of death through a deeper understanding of what death is, then we could get rid of that roadblock that's been standing in our way of happiness. That doesn't mean there aren't other roadblocks, but this is kind of the big one. Now, he's saying, basically, that fearing death is actually quite a silly thing to do. There's no point. It's foolish. Foolish is the person who says that he fears death. Why? Because death is nothing to us. Here's the thing. Think about fear in general. Not just fear of death, but fear in general. Why do you fear anything? Whatever it is, why do you fear something happening? Well, the idea, the basic answer probably is that you fear something, X, whatever X is, you fear X because if X were to happen to you, then that would suck. That would be bad for you. There would be some sort of bad or negative thing involved that would happen to you. It would suck for you, right? But here's the thing. What Epicurus is getting at here when he's saying death is nothing to us is really he's saying death is not something that really will ever happen to you. Death is not something that you are ever going to experience. Why? Because death is the end of experience. When you're dead, there's nothing to experience. There is no you there to experience things, right? That's what he means when he says, when you are, death is not. And when death has come, you are not. That is, if you exist, if you are capable of experiencing, if you are capable of having things happen to you, that means you're alive, i.e., you're not dead. And when you are dead, then you're gone. You are not capable of experiencing anything anymore. Nothing can happen to you anymore because you are gone. So death is not something that ever actually happens to you. So if the reason for fearing anything, X, whatever it is that X happening to you would suck for you, but it's impossible for X to ever happen to you, then it's foolish. It doesn't make any sense to fear it. Doesn't make any sense to fear it. Now, that's a really interesting point, but there's more, right? There's more. Epicurus is not saying that we should just not care, that we should just go do stupid things and you know, jump off a cliff or whatever. He's not saying that. He's saying there's no sense in fearing death because it's going to happen, and when it happens, you're gone, so you're no longer there for it to happen too. So you're not going to care. You're literally not going to care because you're not going to care about anything because you won't exist to care about things. On the other hand, the prospect that your experience and existence will end actually means your life, your current life, is better. The wise person, he says, does not deprecate life, nor does he fear the cessation of life. The thought of life is not an offense to a wise person, nor is the cessation the end of life, regarded as an evil to the wise person. And even as people choose of food not merely and simply the larger portion but the more pleasant, the wise seek to enjoy the time which is most pleasant and not merely that which is longest. In other words, life will come to an end. If you squander your life in misery, fearing the end of that life simply because you want more, that's foolish. What you should do is seek happiness, seek the pleasant life while you're here. And a big part of seeking that pleasant life is to understand that death is not to be feared. It doesn't make sense to fear death. It just doesn't make sense. So, big point, big Epicurus point there. One of the big major things standing in your way of happiness is fear of death. And that's foolish because death is nothing to us. Now, second big point. There is another big thing standing in our way, preventing us from happiness. That is desire. Desire is... it's problematic. Now, he does differentiate between a couple of different kinds of desire, so we'll get that. We'll get to that in a moment. But first off, let's just talk about the nature of desire in the way that we normally think of desire. The groundless ones, as Epicurus says. Okay, so think about things that you desire. You might desire, I don't know, nicer car, better clothes, bigger house, whatever. Whatever it is that you have in this list of desire. Maybe you collect things. Maybe you're a coin collector or a baseball card collector or a antique furniture collector or whatever. Whatever kind of collector you are. Maybe you're some sort of collector and you desire more items in your collection. Whatever it is that you desire. What desire is, as Epicurus sees it here, is a belief that you are incomplete. To say, I desire X, is to say that I am lacking X. And to say that I am lacking X is to say that I'm incomplete. And to say that I'm incomplete is to say that I'm unhappy. Now, the thing about desire, Epicurus notes, is when you have these desires for these things that you think make you, in the lack of which you think make you incomplete, that does a couple of things. First of all, it makes you feel incomplete, which prevents you from being happy. Second, the way desire of that sort tends to work is that it's never actually fulfilled. I mean, think about the collectors among you, or the collectors that any of you might know. If you have any sort of collector mentality about something, what tends to happen with that is that you maybe fill in a hole in that collection. And there's that brief moment of satisfaction, like, oh yeah, that's great, now I got, that's awesome, I got this, now that's great. But how long is it before your mind is on to the next hole in your collection, right? The next thing that you don't have. Probably not too long. As soon as you fill that one hole in the collection, that you're back on eBay or you're back out scouring the antique stores or whatever for to be able to fill the next hole in the collection, right? And whatever, maybe you desire money, right? Well, okay, you get a raise, or you get more money. And there's elation, there's brief elation. Ooh, yes, this is awesome. Look how much better off I am now. How long is it before you're on to, well, when's my next raise going to be? When is the next score going to happen, right? In other words, this desire begets more desire. It tends to be insatiable. It tends to be that you are never truly satisfied when you're ruled by desire. If you're never truly satisfied, you're never truly happy. So, what we should do is purge ourselves of these desires. The idea here is, look, if you are projecting your own completion, right? The completion or the fulfillment of your own selfhood. If you're pegging that on some other things, material possessions or the way other people think about you, whatever it is, if you're pinning it on other things, you're never going to be happy. You're never going to be complete. So, this does not apply to sort of natural basic things, right? That's why he says there are natural desires and then there are groundless ones. The natural ones, some are necessary as well as natural, and some are only natural. the necessary desires, some are necessary if we are to be happy. Some if the body is to be rid of uneasiness. Some if we are even to live. In other words, like, you want food to eat. You want air to breathe. You want water to drink. You want clothes to protect you from the environment. You want a roof over your head to protect you from winter cold and snow and things like that. Right? I mean, these are things that you desire. But those desires are natural, and it turns out they're actually necessary for your own survival. I mean, how can you be happy if you don't exist, or if you're living in a ditch somewhere in the middle of winter? That's not going to be happy. But there are these other desires above and beyond that that are groundless. Right? The idea here is to, as he says, direct every preference and aversion toward securing health of body and tranquility of mind. Because that's what happiness is. The end of all our actions, the goal of all of our actions, is to be free from pain and fear. Once we have attained all this, the tempest of the soul is laid. Right? Pleasure and pain. That's what we're after. Pleasure, happiness, that's the goal. The absence of pain, that's the goal, right? So we have a couple ideas here. First off, there is agreement that happiness is the good. But what Epicurus is getting at here is action. Act such that the consequence is the good life, right? That's what we're after. Act such that the consequence is a pleasant life. That's a different kind of approach, and it is the beginnings of what we're going to call consequentialism. Consequentialism is another of the big three, wherein morality is determined by what happens, what comes from the action, right? So an action is right or wrong, dependent upon the consequences of that action. What is the result of the action? If the result is a good one, the action was a good one. If the result is a bad one, the action was a bad one. The things you should morally do, according to Epicurus, are the things whose consequences will be the happy life. Now, he wants to make this clear. Pleasure is the end and aim. When we say that, we don't mean the pleasures of the prodigal or the pleasures of sensuality. We're not just talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll here. We're talking about the absence of pain in the body and of trouble in the soul. That's what he says right there. The absence of pain in the body and of trouble in the soul. The idea of pleasure, the idea of the good, in Epicurus's mind, is happiness, yes, but it's not sex, drugs, rock and roll happiness. It's not even eudaimonia happiness. It's what's known as ataraxia happiness. A-T-A-R-A-X-I-A. Ataraxia. And this ataraxia is contentment and freedom from want. It's the absence of pain in the body and the absence of trouble in the soul. It's about contentment. It's about being complete. Now, as I said before, this is quite different than the way Epicurean as an adjective is used these days. It's about not being gluttonous. It's about not being overly desirous and greedy. It's about saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, I don't really need that stuff. I don't really need all that extra stuff. Maybe I should just chill. Maybe I should just be kind of happy and content with what I have. And that's indeed what he says in the end of the previous paragraph, the one about desire. He's saying, look, if we're thinking about these desires that we have, if we're thinking about the basic ones, the basic needs that we have, those are actually pretty easy to get. It's not that hard. If we're talking about the basic needs, the things that you need just to survive, just to live, the basic necessities, it's not that hard to do, right? I mean, it's not really that hard to get basic stuff. We want all this extra stuff. We want the huge TVs. We want the nice cars. We want the fancy furniture. We want the granite countertops in our kitchen. We want the big 7,000 square foot houses. We want all that sort of stuff. We want that stuff. We want the designer clothes. We want the jewelry. We want all, whatever it is. We want that stuff. But none of that stuff is necessary. All you really need is enough food to keep you healthy. Enough food and water to keep you healthy, right? Enough clothes and enough shelter to keep you protected from the elements and to keep you safe and warm, right? And the ability to contemplate, the ability to think, the ability to pursue your own inner goals and inner strengths and things like that. That's all we really need. To do that isn't really that difficult. You can do that on a minimum wage job pretty easily. But we only think these things are terrible. We only think these kinds of minimum wage jobs are terrible and underpaid is because we want so much other stuff besides. If we could just be content, we'd all be fine. To habituate one's self, therefore, to simple and inexpensive diet supplies all that is needful for health and enables a person to meet the necessary requirements of life without shrinking, and it places us in a better condition when we approach at intervals a costly fare and renders us fearless of fortune. These sorts of things are not that hard to do. They're easily procured. The vain and the worthless pursuits, those are the ones that he says are hard to win. So, I would like to ask you guys what you make of this approach. First off, there's a few big major points to make here. First off, we have an agreement with Aristotle that happiness is the good. But later on, we get an understanding that the happiness that Epicurus is talking about is a little different than the happiness that Aristotle was talking about. Aristotle used eudaimonia. Epicurus uses ataraxia. Secondly, we get a major departure from virtue theory, where we're focusing on action. We're focusing on do this, do this, do this. Purge yourself of this. Think of this this way. That sort of thing. Such that the consequences of your actions will be happiness. Ataraxia. That's the beginnings of what we call consequentialism. And we get these kind of two big points. One about the fear standing in your way of this contentment, and the big one being fear of death, but that's silly. And the second one about these vain desires standing in the way of your happiness, and we need to get rid of those desires because then life would be so much better. The vain and worthless desires, those are the ones that are hard to fulfill, and they're never actually fulfilled. You'll never be complete. You'll never feel content when you're ruled by those things. But isn't that actually good news? Because the necessary things, the necessities that you need, they're actually pretty easy to do. In other words, what Epicurus is saying here is living the happy life, attaining ataraxia, it's right in front of you. It's not some golden hilltop far off on the horizon that you have to navigate to get to. It's right in front of you. The only thing standing in your way is your own hang-ups, right? Your own hang-ups on desire and fear and all the rest. Drop that baggage, get rid of those things. There you go. There's ataraxia waiting for you. So, what do you think of this? What do you think of this approach? What do you think of what Epicurus is getting at here? It ought to remind you a bit of a different kind of thing, a different kind of viewpoint that you may be a bit familiar with. But we don't need to get into that. I want to know what you think about this approach. Are his arguments about death and desire good ones? Do you tend to agree with him, or do you think he's missing something? Do you think there are problems? We are going to look at the expansion and development of this consequentialist style, this consequentialist way of looking at things. We're going to expand on that coming up. We have one more stop to make in our chronological journey here before we get to more modern times and talk about it. But we will develop this a bit further with people like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. But for now, we have this interesting Epicurean approach of ataraxia, contentment, freedom from want. It's about free from pain in the body and trouble in the soul. What do you make of that? You think Epicurus is on the right track, or do you think he's missing something important?